Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I am joined by Tom Lang, who spent nearly three decades as a police officer and a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department, and he and his former partner Robert Souza are out with a brand new book. It's called The Dirty Business of Murder, the inside story of homicide investigation in the City of Angels. They also co-wrote Malice in Wonderland, the inside story of the police investigation of the Laurel Canyon murders. And Tom, as we dive into this, the whole idea of you coming on the LAPD in 1967, in a macabre way, for somebody that works homicides, I know you didn't start working homicides, but that era of Los Angeles, in Los Angeles, was probably the halcyon days for murder investigations, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. The 60s, things were much more wide open. In fact, we had a number of serial killings that began, I guess, mid-70s, and went right into the 1980s, and into the 90s, and we had like something like 25 different serial killing cases over that time period. And not just single killers. We had some of them with two and three killers involved in each one of those cases. And in one, the freeway killer, the violent case, he had five accomplices at one time or another. So it was a very busy time with serial killers, and that we haven't had anything since, and certainly nothing before. But in those times, we had the crime rate back then was something like 75% above what it is today, and of course that includes homicides.
So as you get on the LAPD, you don't start as a detective, obviously. You start, I would imagine, as a patrol officer. But so I can't imagine that they train you to be a detective in the academy, because everybody isn't going to be a detective. So what is it when you go from not being a detective to being a detective? Do you go to school for it, or how does that work at the LAPD at your time?
Yeah, well, there's loans for people who are interested in doing that type of a thing. There are detective schools. However, the best trainer is experience. Always has been, always will be, especially when you're talking about homicides. I was interested in these things, and if you're not really care for what you're doing and you don't respect it, you're not going to do very well at all. It's as simple as that. You have to really want to do it and want to get into it, ask questions, be nosy. And I wanted to get a loan because I wanted something different. It can be a little mundane when you work in a patrol car year in, year out, decade after decade. So I wanted something different. You have to train basic things, but the best way is to get out there and work with people who have done it for a number of years, and you pick things up. Now, I was involved in about 200 different murder investigations over a 22-year period and working just homicides, and I learned something new every time I went out there. I mean, there's not two that's ever been exactly alike, so you're constantly learning. And you got to be open to that, and you got to really want to do it. And if you like it, you'll probably be pretty successful at it.
How does a crime scene go from just a patrol officer investigating it to calling in a detective unit? Where's the threshold there? I mean, you're not going to show up for a shoplifting.
No. There's different units that handle different specialties as far as investigation goes. You got a juvenile unit that handles, 18 and under, 17 and under actually, juveniles. 18 out here, of course, is a legal age. You have a robbery unit that would exclusively handle robberies. You have a burglary unit, exclusively handle that. You have a sex unit, the same. And of course you have your homicide teams. Now at the time, in the 60s, we had like 18 different geographical divisions in the city. LA is a very huge city and it's spread out over a large area, and so we had large geographical areas. Today they have something like 22 geographical areas, but each area had its own homicide team, anywhere from usually two to six or eight different members who exclusively would handle homicide investigations. Of course, homicide doesn't always mean just murder. It's any death by another human being, and it would include officer-involved type shootings, legally proper shootings, and these types of things. So you would be constricted just to your basic geographical unit. And I was for the downtown unit in Central Division for about 3 or 4 years until we had a couple of serial killing cases that occurred downtown. And I was transferred into the robbery homicide unit at that point. Now, robbery homicide unit has citywide jurisdictions and usually handles high publicity cases, serial killing cases, things are going to take more time and probably more experience to deal with, and that's where everybody in the geographical units tries to get to eventually. So I was afforded an opportunity because of the Skid Row Stabber case in downtown to go on loan, and so I went to robbery homicide at that time. That was 1978, and I was lucky enough to get that case solved, and I ended up staying there for the rest of my career.
One of the little tidbits you added in here, and Sousa talked about it too, is that, and it surprised me to read, you didn't have a lot of respect for authority when you joined the LAPD. I think you're working at a service station or a gas station, and you're back from serving in the Marines in Vietnam. So what was your attitude joining the LAPD? Because it sounds like it was a different route to the LAPD than I would have expected.
Yeah. I had a rotten attitude. I suppose some people could understand that. I was a young kid, 21 years old, getting back from Vietnam, and I was a squad leader. Saw 11 months of combat and a lot of things that, to this day, kind of just frankly pissed me off. And I was not in good terms with myself or anybody else. I was drinking. I was getting involved in stuff that I shouldn't have. I finally had to find a job because I was living out of my car half the time. So I did get a job in a service station, and there was a cop that used to come in there all the time and said, you know, you've got good experience and all, and the LAPD is hiring. And I said, his name was Rick, nice guy, and I said, Rick, I don't even like cops. You're a good guy. I like you. You come in here and all, we talk, but I don't care anything about being a cop. So I got to thinking about these things, and one day I'm reading something in the LA Times, and there was a big window in the center of the page. It said Los Angeles hiring policemen. It wasn't police officers then, it was policemen, $641 a month. And I'm looking at that, and I said, you can't spend that much money. So that's probably the first reason I went in. And I got in, and I took my oral, and there was an old horse Marine. He had to be in his 80s. That was there, and of course, we just talked about the Marine Corps, and one thing led to another, and pretty soon I knew I was involved in police work in Hollywood Division.
I'm chatting with Tom Lang, a retired detective from LAPD. He's out with a new book, The Dirty Business of Murder, The Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels. Tom, homicide is so ingrained in the myth of Hollywood, of Los Angeles. I mean, there's whole tourism industries built on dearly departed sites of famous murders and all that. And so as you look at this from a former homicide detective's perspective, does all that glorification of the homicide, does that hinder anything that the police actually do?
Not if you keep your head straight. Again, what I said earlier, you have to really want to do this stuff. The good thing about most homicide investigations is you're going to be left alone, even if it's a high-profile case. The brass understands that you've got a job to do. It's very difficult, and you can't be too verbal about it. You've got to keep things close to the vest, and if you're upset with the politics or anything else, you've just got to set that aside and put your mind into what you're doing. A high-publicity case with a celebrity involved shouldn't be any different than the poor transient lying in an alley with his neck sliced and lying there for 2 days and nobody even calling on him. You have to get all of that out of your mind and do what you're getting paid to do there, and one is the same as the other. And you've got to have respect for what you do, and you respect yourself and your evidence. It's all about the evidence and keeping the evidence close and just doing your job. And usually you'll get left alone doing that. At least I was basically left alone the whole time, and I think that's one reason we're able to solve all of those serial killing cases and everything else that basically we handle.
And you were working as a detective at a time before DNA was really coming into the forefront, and so you had a lot of shoe leather involved in this. And so as I think back, now it seems like if you watch crime shows on TV, no murder gets solved without DNA. You were solving murders before DNA, and so is it almost easier for detectives now with DNA to back up what they're doing, or how's that changed?
Well, it's changed, of course, and it's obviously changed for the better with DNA. You have communications has improved tremendously. You have different sets of the skills you can use through criminalists. I mean, we didn't even have criminalists working crime scenes back then. I could give you a story. In fact, one I like to tell, it was in the early 70s. I was working downtown, and at night, downtown L.A. just kind of folds up. There's nothing going on, except there's an area just east of downtown, an industrial area, where there are two or three bars, and people get together there on Saturday nights, and there are usually fights and stabbings and this type of thing. So there was a call that came in, and there was a body in an alley. And my partner and I were on call, so we rolled out to it. And that particular night, in downtown, there were three murders. So my partner was senior, so he had the car. We had to get assistance from our detective headquarters bureau to handle the other case, and I was on the third murder of this young Hispanic kid who'd been beaten and stabbed and left dead in an alley. And we got the information on an anonymous phone call. Back then, there was no communications. I mean, we didn't have cell phones. If you didn't have a public phone nearby and a quarter, I mean, you were screwed. It was just you, and I can recall standing in the alley at 3 a.m. With my flashlight and my clipboard, and with this body of this young kid lying in a heap, glass, blood everywhere, nobody securing the scene. Of course, there was nobody around, so it didn't matter. So I'm doing what I can do. Meanwhile, my partner's handling one of these other homicides. The photographer shows up. We shoot the scene. Now I'm waiting for a coroner. So at that time, we did all our own crime scene work with the photographer. So the coroner finally shows up. It's after 5 in the morning. And he pulls in, and this will be the end for me, and hopefully my partner will be coming around and picking me up. And he's backing in. And I'm looking around to make sure I've completed everything, and all of a sudden I hear, oh, shit. And I turn around, and the coroner is backed in, and he's opened up the rear, and he doesn't have any room for my body. There were already four bodies in there. He'd just forgotten and lost track of where he was going from one scene to the other. Now, only two of those were homicides. The other, I believe, were accident victims. So we just rolled up the body, of course, and had to put him in the best way we could. Luckily, the coroner's office is only a couple of miles away. But back then, you would have murders that people were never even identified at times. They could have been much better handled if we'd had a criminalist there and took the time and everything else. But we'd go in for an autopsy on a Sunday morning. It'd be two or three bodies on a cart just waiting to be autopsied. It was much different. Again, like I said, I think in 1992, I believe we had 1,092 homicides in the city alone, another 3,000 in the county. And today, I mean, 2 years ago in L.A., I don't even think there were 350. So you're looking at like a 75% decrease in homicides over the last 30 years that what we used to deal with back in the 70s and the 80s.
At any given time, how many active homicide cases would you have as a detective?
Me personally at the time?
Right.
Well, it would vary. The serial killing age kind of threw that off because, you know, you don't have how many that you're really carrying in some of these cases. You may have 2 or 3 or 30. I usually find out about that many years later. But I would say the year or two that we discussed, I think, in the book, we had like 50 different cases going on, going back a number of years. But some of the cases, one case, it was an arson murder, there were 25 victims. In other words, the Laurel Canyon murders, there were 5 victims. Then we had a couple of serial killing cases where there were a couple of dozen victims apiece. You had doubles, you had triples. So they add up. So there'd be several dozen at any one time. And we were just going. Sometimes we'd carry 3 or 4 at the same time. So this is not a 9-to-5 job Monday through Friday. Let's just put it like that.
All right. He's Tom Lang. The book is The Dirty Business of Murder, the inside story of homicide investigation in the City of Angels. We're going to have Tom back next time to talk a little bit more about this book and his other book, Malice in Wonderland, the inside story of the police investigation of the Laurel Canyon murders. Tom, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. And welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Tom Lang, retired detective from the Los Angeles Police Department. His new book is The Dirty Business of Murder, the inside story of homicide investigation in the City of Angels. He co-wrote it with his former partner, Robert Souza. Tom also co-wrote with Robert Malice in Wonderland, the inside story of the police investigation of the Laurel Canyon murders. Tom, getting into your book, The Dirty Business of Murder, I think the most interesting chapter I read in that book was about autopsies. And from Adam 12 and Dragnet on through the shows today, you rarely get a glimpse of what the homicide detective does at an autopsy, and I just never think about it. So can you explain, as the homicide detective, it's got to be the worst part of the job, other than maybe notifying people of a death.
Yeah, it is. It's not a pleasant thing, but you need to understand why you're there, and the fact that some people really don't understand is that in a homicide and a murder, all homicides, especially in a murder investigation, the body of the victim is in fact evidence. Everything about the body is evidence. The way the body is found, any blood tailing or trailing on the body, any of the wounds on the body, perimortal or antemortem wounds, are evidence. The mode of death, the type of death, weapons used, the liver temperature, lividity involved, all of these things are evidence as to when this occurred, where it occurred, and maybe why it occurred. When you go to the autopsy, you have to be there and as a witness and work with the pathologist and the coroner there and get to the bottom of how this happened, perhaps why it happened, the weapons used, what actually caused the death, and work with the coroner's people as they have done their own investigation. Now, at a murder scene, when you're through, you call the coroner, and they do their own independent investigation themselves. So in a sense, you're comparing notes. You're asking all sorts of questions of the pathologist at the time to find out answers to all of these questions, because later on, in this case of assault, you will be testifying to everything that you discovered and found, not just at the crime scene, but at the autopsy, which in a sense is an extension of the crime scene.
And then you explain that there's two types of autopsies, which I didn't know. Can you explain those?
Well, there's different levels of autopsies. Now, the murder type, that's a full autopsy, that you would have to be there. There are others where things might be suspected, such as overdose. You're not necessarily going to be there unless there's some evidence to show that the overdose was not voluntary, these types of things. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether you have a murder or you have a different type of homicide. Of course, murder is indeed a homicide, but there are homicides that are by police and accidental, and sometimes accidental, that as long as the person is killed by another human being, it's a homicide, and not necessarily means you have to be there at the examination. Sometimes these things fail if you're busy, and you'll get a call at the coroner's office saying, you know, somebody showed up with a body here, and they didn't turn over the body, and there's a hole in the back. These type of things happen. But most of those autopsies are, in fact, as you say, clinical, and the other ones are when the body is indeed evidence and part of a crime. You always want to be there.
And then you had a particular ritual regarding a car wash, right?
Yeah. Okay. When we, a lot of stuff was old-fashioned. We used to go into the coroner's office, and like I say, it was a very busy place, and you would have people who wouldn't be wearing masks. I know the day they mask and they gown up and you have booties on and all these other things. Back in the day, you didn't have any of that stuff on. And as you can imagine, it smelled really, really bad. When you have 8 or 10 autopsies going on, and you never get used to the smell. So we used to have we used to light up a cigar. And, of course, there's no smoking over there anymore, and some people would even have their lunch over there. I mean, the coroner's folks get so used to doing these things, they almost get used to these smells. But we might handle dozens of autopsies over the year, and you just never get used to it. The other problem is we didn't wear booties back then, and so we would leave an autopsy, and Bob and I would head back to Parker Center where they had a car wash. And the first thing we do out of the car is walk through the car wash in our feet to clean our shoes off after walking through all the stuff that's just thrown around in the coroner's office, blood and everything else. Of course, a day with the pathogens and everything else, again, everybody has booties on and they're all gowned up. But back then, that was the way we used to clean ourselves, wash ourselves down good and walk through the car wash so we could clean our shoes.
As you, in the book, it was the serial killer era in Los Angeles, and a lot of it was media-driven, and we see it on the shows about how the brass gets excited because the LA Times puts a story out and we need to solve these things, but how media-driven were these serial killings? I mean, did you always agree with the media as far as what they were saying that a serial killer was? Because they're the ones that come up with all these names for them.
Yeah, no, you keep your distance from the media, and if you're talking about a serial killing case, you don't want to be talking to them yourselves. So usually, the press information officer that does that themselves, and they will come to you first before they make any release. Sometimes you have some independent news folks, especially back, you know, in the 60s, maybe in the 70s and 80s, who'd show up and they'd snoop around, and some of them you could trust, some of them you couldn't. But again, your job is to protect the evidence, because one day you're going to have a suspect, and you're going to want to know things that only he knows and you knows. And this goes the same for witnesses. You don't want witnesses to shy away from you. You want witnesses to come, and you want their information to be confidential. So you need to watch who you talk to. And, you know, the media is there to do a job, and you have to respect them to do their job, but you also have to realize you have a case to protect, and if something gets out, then, I mean, that could be your whole case. The media was involved, for the most part, with all the sensationalism, you know, naming these cases. Of course, the media, you have to understand their job. A story is not a story without conflict. And, you know, I love to read and I love to write and everything else, but you're looking for the conflict. You're looking for a story to be built. They're not there to just report, you know, 2 and 2 is 4 and this is it and black is black and white is white. They need conflict to show these stories, and you have to be careful of those types of things and who you talk to and what you tell them. And, again, you want to do this through a PIO. You don't want to be letting anything out yourself.
I'm chatting with retired LAPD Detective Tom Lang. The new book is The Dirty Business of Murder, the inside story of homicide investigation in the City of Angels. He co-wrote it with his former partner, Robert Souza. Tom, there's a story in the book that I chuckled when I read it. Not all homicides that you quote-unquote solve end up in a conviction because of various things. Witnesses go bad or whatever. There's one where you encountered somebody who you knew was a murderer later on, and it involved fight night. Can you tell me that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was kind of a humorous story. It was a cold case that I had picked up that actually occurred in 1974, involving an old-time actor from the 60s by the name of Chet Marshall. If anybody's familiar with the West Point series, I think it was 1961. He was an actor back then and fairly well-known at the time, but he was murdered, I believe it was about 1974, and I think I picked it up in 1980, 81 or 82, as a cold case. And there was a suspect initially that they liked, but the initial detectives liked, but there was never enough to file a case. Well, there was a few things happened when you get a cold case. Things usually advance and people find more evidence the more you dig. Well, I found an ex-wife of the suspect, and of course there's a certain law that says, you know, that a man cannot testify against his wife or vice versa, and he doesn't have to testify, this type of thing, which was one reason that this guy wasn't filed on. Anyway, the woman had been involved in a very contentious divorce with her husband, who was the suspect. One thing led to another, and he ends up terrifying her and coming out in the middle of the night and scaring her and flattening her tires and all these types of things. And when I re-interviewed her, she's telling me all these things, and we were looking at a very dangerous individual, and to make it a little shorter, she was ready to testify. One thing led to another, and I built a case on him, and I went out and arrested him. And this is years later, and I filed a case with the district attorney, and without going through a lot of the other things, she was very key as a witness. But, of course, she was at one time married to him, and she developed dementia, and there were a couple of other problems, to the point where the district attorney dropped the case. You got to get used to these types of things. The district attorneys have a different agenda than you do as a homicide cop. It's as simple as that. Sometimes it's politics, sometimes it's not. Whatever it is, it's their choice, whether they're going to go ahead with it or they're going to drop it. So they drop the case, and meanwhile, our guy is out. So he's running around, I was off duty, and a good friend of mine about once a month had what they call fight night. He'd have all the guys over, and we'd drink beer and watch the fights, and there were two TV sets, and he'd order food and everything else. And so I was invited there, and I showed up kind of late. And my buddy came, and we were talking, and he says, yeah, what do you think of this setup now? We've got more guys coming. You know, about 15 or 20 guys there, and it's loud, and some people are smoking cigars, and they're drinking beer, and they're screaming at the TV. And my buddy Floyd says, yeah, I got food coming in my house. He says, in fact, this time I even hired a bartender. I said, well, that's pretty cool. He says, yeah, I met him in the bar, and the guy's a bartender. He says, he's doing a great job. Come on over. I want you to meet him. So we go over there, and he says, I won't mention his last name, but I'll give you his first name. He says, we walk up to the bar, and the bartender is faced away from me, and he's making a drink or something. And Floyd says, hey, Don, this is Tom. Tom Lang, this is Don so-and-so. And we turn around, and we're shaking hands and looking at each other. That's my murder suspect that he hired as a bartender. We're shaking hands, and we look at each other, and of course, we drop our handshake like we were shaking a rattlesnake or something. He turns around, and I grab Floyd, and they were off, and I said, this guy is a killer. Is this guy? Anyway, he split, and he didn't even get paid. He never came back. And he died a couple years ago. But that was kind of funny. You're shaking your hand at the murder suspect.
When you when you write a book, former detective, is it like people that worked for the federal government and the CIA or anything? Is the LAPD have any content control, or are you free to talk about anything?
Well, it depends on the case. Free to talk to other agencies, you're saying?
No, free to write about it.
Yeah, you've got to check what you're doing. In fact, there's one story in here where I've changed a few things around because it's still an active investigation. This has to do with a police officer who was believed to have killed his wife, and this is an ongoing investigation. So you have to watch what you say, and you got to change the names and everything else. If you're going to say anything about that or write anything about it, in this case, this book has a couple of things like that. It is a couple of different officers involved in murders as suspects. And there's three cases involved in three different officers who were murdered in shootouts who were partners and friends of ours that we also bring out. But you have to watch what you say and then who you say it about if these things haven't been, settled in court.
Is that something you're required to do, or is that just something you do because that's the honorable thing to do?
Well, it can be the honorable thing to do, certainly. It's just common sense also. You still have to respect the system. If somebody hasn't been convicted of something, you can't go laying them out and say, I think this, that, and the other. And all you have to do is look at the Simpson case. very few people think that he is not the suspect who killed two people. The vast majority of human beings who know anything about the case believes he, in fact, is the suspect for every reason you can imagine. But you have to respect our system. The system says that he's not guilty for whatever reason. So you have to be careful with that, and it's just common sense.
All right, he's Tom Lang. The book is The Dirty Business of Murder, the Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels. Tom's seen it all. Tom, we're going to have you back next time, all right?
Thank you very much, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Tom Lang, retired LAPD detective, who, along with his former partner Robert Souza, co-wrote the book The Dirty Business of Murder, the Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels. They are also the co-authors of Malice in Wonderland, the Inside Story of the Police Investigation of the Laurel Canyon Murders. Tom, I know that you were working at the LAPD at the same time as Joseph Wambaugh, who's the famous crime writer, and Onion Field, and then all the books that came after that. What was the idea that an active LAPD officer was writing books? Was that looked down upon by anybody? Was it a pride thing? How did that work?
That's one way to put it, looked down upon. It was frowned upon. It was just kind of an on, you know, nobody ever tried it before Wambaugh. It was just kind of a something that you didn't talk about. You were not expected to talk about what you did as a cop. I mean, there's nothing written on that, but Wambaugh, of course, changed all that around. He's phenomenal writer. He's very talented, and he wasn't a homicide cop or anything. He actually worked burglary in Hollenbeck Division for about 15 years, but he was a very good writer, and as demonstrated by only the bestsellers that he wrote. But he wasn't real popular with the brass because he wouldn't want them. They wouldn't want him talking about them. And let's face it, the police departments, especially big city police departments, are bureaucracies. They got in the way in the Simpson case. So we wanted to arrest Simpson and not make a big deal out of it. And no, they had to have him show up. So instead he takes off and there's this big pursuit and everything else. Well, we could have arrested him one night and nobody would have would have cared one way or the other what we did. But the brass had to make a big deal out of it. So that's one of the problems you encounter. But when you start writing about those things, it can upset a lot of people. So you just got to be careful with that and use a little common sense. And, of course, it helps to write these books when you're retired, not when you're active.
How important is the relationship between partners? Because you had several over the years. Everybody knows your former partner, the late Phil Van Adder. But, Bob Souza was your partner, and you worked with several of them. Are those just like marriages? Some are better than others?
That's a good way to put it. Sometimes you get along, sometimes you don't. If you're not on the same page and you don't get along, you're not going to do real well. It's as simple as that. You're as good as your partner and vice versa. Bob and I, it got to the point where we just look at each other and we know exactly what the other one's thinking. It's almost freakish. We grew up the same way in the same areas and went through a lot of the same stuff. But from the first day we worked together, the first case we handled was the Laurel Canyon Murders. That case lasted for 20 years. But throughout the whole thing, Bob had retired after several of years, and I kept it and got a new partner. But we kept in touch all the way through the last 45, 50 years. We talk all the time. He lives out of state, and we decided we're talking about all these old cases. The other thing that we had in common was we'd always write everything down. We keep personal diaries. I did that in the Simpson case. I wrote over 500 pages of stuff, and that's the basis for the book that I wrote, Evidence Dismissed, which was a bestseller. From all of these things that we wrote down over the years, we said, we ought to put these things together and write a book because, we both like to write and we both like to read. And these are interesting cases. Now, this the dirty business of murder. We've got a variety of cases from everything you can think of, including these serial killing cases and organized crime cases and cop cases and everything you could throw out there. And it's just fun. You know, the whole thing is an anthology, and so we're able to do a little bit of everything. And so, like I said earlier, if you like doing this stuff, you're probably pretty good at it.
And the anthology you put together, it's several cases that you've pared down to about 10 pages apiece, and you touch on several of them, several cases that went on over the years. But one in particular I was thinking about is we had Matt McGough on a few years ago talking about his book, The Lazarus Files, about the Stephanie Lazarus case. And your connection to that case was involved, she's a police officer that ended up being convicted of a murder on a cold case with DNA, but you'd see her at the gym, and so is hindsight 2020 on something like that? Did a lot of her interactions with you mean more after you found out what was going on with her?
Yeah, I think so, because as I also mentioned in the book, I knew her many years ago. I considered her a friend, and I used to go down, and still do, every day I go to the gym, and unless we were busy with something in downtown in Parker Center, I go down to the basement and work out in the gym for an hour or so every afternoon, if I could fit it in. And this was the men's gym. Now, we didn't have a lot of women on the job back then, so you didn't have a women's gym or you didn't have a women's locker room. But she used to come in there and was the only female that would come in there, and she wouldn't bother anybody. She's very nice, and that's when I first met her in the guy's gym. Of course, there's nobody running around naked or anything, so it wasn't a big deal because the weight room is kind of set off from the gym. But I got to know her, and we're talking about various things, and, you know, you meet people in life, especially if you do what I did, and you look into people's personality a little bit more than most, perhaps, and for a cop, and I've known an awful lot of women cops who were just really outstanding at what they did, and they would be a little more outgoing with it, and she just never was. There was something there. I just couldn't figure out what it was, so I knew her for all these years, and then I retired. And I was working out in my local gym out here in Oak Ridge, and where I live, after I'd been retired, and she was coming in there because she lived out near, not 2 miles from where I was. And she got married, and they adopted a little girl, and so we talked a little bit, and how things were going, and next thing I know, she gets arrested. So, and all these things start coming back, and she had went to the residence of her ex-boyfriend, where he'd married another woman and got into a fight with the other woman, who was ended up winning the fight. And so Stephanie pulled out her gun and shot her 3 times and killed her and took off. And one thing led to another, and then DNA finally came along, and a couple of very bright young cops in Van Nuys put the case together and followed her around, and she dumped a lemonade cup, I think, down in Costco out here, and they picked it up and got DNA, and one thing led to another, and pretty soon she found herself in the office there with these two homicide cops accusing her basically of murder, and she was convicted, and she's still in prison.
Chatting with Tom Lang. His new book is The Dirty Business of Murder, The Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels. He co-wrote it with his former partner, Robert Souza. Tom, Robert has a book in the, a chapter in the book, and it's recounting his thoughts about attending an execution. And executions are rare in California, but I know you haven't attended one yourself, but is that anything you'd want to see?
I don't have any desire to see those things. I've seen, since I was 19 years old, I've seen so many people. After a while, you say, you know, what's the use of all this? There's nothing I'm proud of, because I had to work around people who had been killed or anything else. If anything, it's a challenge. I think if you're a homicide cop, you have to like a challenge, because it's going to be a challenge to get through all that stuff that you have to get through, to get the evidence, to prove things, to do this, to do that. You have to be of a certain mind, and I think that's what it was. And again, like I said earlier, you have to respect it, but I wouldn't care to be there. I think Bob was invited to be there, and it's a little hard to turn down something if you've sent somebody to the death chamber and your investigation is responsible for them taking their lives, maybe it's also out of respect that they should show up. I don't know. For the families, perhaps. But Bob did that, and I'd never heard of that before, seeing a case through for like 20 years from the outset to the arrest, to the conviction, to when they put the needle in Bonin's arm and he saw him die like that. There's no great pride or victory or anything else. It's just part of the job, and you have to look at it like that.
You've sat across the table from some horrendous people, and I know that you recount an interview in the book about it was a large-scale drug operation that was going on in California, and it involved somebody in Florida, and one of the people's sons had died, and he made the comment to you, business is business. And when you're sitting there, I mean, and you know, you've got your own set of morals and ethics, and you sit and listen to somebody spouting something, does the adrenaline take over in your body, and how do you learn to control that when you just want to reach across the table and choke them?
That's a really good question. I'd have to... Initially, things kind of bothered me. Death never did. It was part of what I did, and I have to accept that. But when you have a father, you talk about an organized crime murder, a double that we handled in L.A. The bodies were found up, wrapped up in tarp. They'd been tortured, shot in the back of the head. There was expensive jewelry on both of the bodies. There was a large amount of cash in the bodies. These are message killings. These two had come in to L.A. to do some business. They're dope dealers, and they didn't check with the right people at the right time, I guess, and they ended up dead and getting tortured and everything else. So I wanted to talk to the family, and the family was down in Coconut Grove, Florida, just outside of Miami, and they were under federal indictments at the time as big-time coke dealers, and I'm surprised that they allowed us to even come and see them, but they did. And you don't come in under those circumstances pushy or I got you now or too bad about your son, but he had it coming type of thing. You come in there with your hat in your hand if you want to really care and get any information at all that's going to help you solve these murders. When we came in, we introduced ourselves, and we were sorry for the death of his son and everything else, and sir, we'd just like to ask you if you can help us handle this case. We know that they came out here from Florida. So he had his attorneys there, and he had a couple of bodyguards and everybody else standing around staring at us at this beautiful home with a 180-degree view of Biscayne Bay. And he's sitting there, and he was really hurt. He said, "Detectives, you have to understand that I love my son very much, but business is business." And Bob and I looked at each other, and we said, well, that takes care of that. We're not about to get anything from this guy. And then we knew that coming in, we had to try it. So you respect it, but you have your own personal feelings. You keep them to yourself. Later on, we're discussing this thing, and their business might have been. I doubt whoever killed his son, they're probably not around either. So sometimes you have to do all you can do, and that's all you can do. And you let those things go where they have to go.
You talked in the book also about the sheer number of unsolved homicides in Los Angeles, a metropolis of that size. It's to be expected. But when you started working homicides, does somebody tell you, hey, you're not going to solve all of them, just to get you ready for that mindset because you don't want to look at it as a failure, but nonetheless, all you can do is all you can do?
No, nobody really said that. I mean, you pick up things in a hurry, and kind of alluded to it earlier. If you don't, you're not going to do too well, and you're not going to be around long. You have to be of a special mindset to deal with these types of things. And if you're not, we've had people that you worked homicide for a couple of weeks and just say, hey, this isn't for me, I'm out of here. Again, with me, it was a challenge. But you're not going to win all of them. You're not going to win all the time. You're going to win what you're going to win and then move on. Early on, like I said, the interesting thing turned out to be DNA with all these cold cases. A cold case today is a euphemism. Basically, what we call a DNA case. Basically, that's what it is. And a lot of them are being solved. We got one case in the in a book by a homicide team that I'm very familiar with and know very well, is 42 years old. And the officers that handled initial one was out of our unit, and they did all they can do without DNA. DNA came along, and these two outstanding male-female team solved this 42-year-old murder through DNA, but it also was a lot of work. It just wasn't a magic potion that came along. They had to do the work. So things change eventually. The clearance rate has improved greatly since DNA and a lot of other systems, automated systems that they have now that we didn't have then back then. So things eventually improve, but all you can do is what you can do at the time, and you got to move on.
All right. Well, the book is The Dirty Business of Murder, the inside story of homicide investigation in the City of Angels. He's Tom Lang, former LAPD detective, wrong coast, and his former partner Robert Sousa wrote it. Tom, we're going to have you back one more time. We're going to talk about Malice in Wonderland, all right?
Sounds good, Brian. Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by retired LAPD detective Tom Lang, who, along with his co-author Robert Sousa, it's also his former partner, they've written two books, The Dirty Business of Murder, The Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels, and for our purposes today, Malice in Wonderland, The Inside Story of the Police Investigation of the Laurel Canyon Murders. Tom, this one had all kinds of the names for it. The Laurel Canyon Murders, Four on the Floor, Malice in Wonderland, all of that. But setting this up for us, first time you and Sousa ever worked together, and so just the crime scene itself, I know there's videos out there of where it happened. It was the first crime scene to actually use video. You made that famous video of taking the crime scene. So can you kind of just take us through the basic nuts and bolts of the actual murder?
Yeah, well, it's a little involved. This was a bunch of bikers, a bunch of badass dope-dealing bikers who were ripping other dope dealers off, and the bottom line here, I guess, would be they ripped off the wrong one. This occurred back in July the 1st, 1981, and we had a local OC figure by the name of Ed Nash who ran a number of nightclubs in the L.A. area. And on the side, of course, he was one of the major cocaine dealers in all of the West Coast. And had a lot of people working for him. Well, this local gang, decided to rip him off. And in the middle of all this, as a lot of your younger listeners may not know who John Holmes was, but he was a very well-known porn actor back in the day, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And he was also well into cocaine. So he was going to this organized crime figure, getting his fixes all the time for a number of months. Unbeknownst to us, he was also a police informant that we didn't find out until later on. Anyway, one thing led to another, and he was also dealing with this gang, this street gang, the Laurel Canyon, the Wonderland Gang, you should call them. And he went to them once and said, "Hey, I know this guy. He's got all sorts of dope up there. He's got all sorts of cash. He's a bodyguard, but I think we can get around him. If you get into this guy early in the morning, he can rip him off and, you know, a big score." So they set this hit up, this Wonderland gang does, and Ed Nash. And they go up in the early morning, and just before this, the evening before, John Holmes was up there scoring, and he leaves the rear sliding door ajar for these guys to come in and surprise Ed Nash and his bodyguard and rip him off. So they do this the following morning. There were three of them with a fourth one in a stolen vehicle outside waiting for them. So they go into the house, one thing leads to another, and they're beating, slapping people around and everything else and threatening people, and one of them has an accidental discharge and shoots the bodyguard. It's not a fatal wound at all, but just set things right in Nash's mind, and they're intimidating Nash. They stick the barrel of the gun one of them did down his throat and threatened to blow his brains out and all this other thing. Bottom line is they went away with a considerable amount of cocaine and several $100,000 in cash. And they left them there and went home to Wonderland, 8763 Wonderland Avenue, which is, as the crow flies, is just like only 2 miles away. Obviously, when this was never reported to the police, you're not going to report something when one dope dealer rips off another dope dealer, obviously. So one thing leads to another, and about 4 a.m. on the morning of July 1st, the robbery occurred like 2 days before. In the meantime, Ed Nash gets word about John Holmes. He thinks that John Holmes is involved in this one way or the other, which he is. So they tie Holmes to a chair, and they beat this little bit of a confession out of him. He gives up the Wonderland gang, tells them what happened, where these guys are now, the whole nine yards. July 1st, 4 a.m., the four or five suspects show up at Wonderland early in the morning. There's six people inside the house, including John Holmes. There's a tap on the door. John Holmes goes and lets these four or five suspects in. They're all carrying pipes. They enter the house, and they go to work on everybody in the house. There's a woman, a young woman, in the front room, and then she gets beaten down onto the floor. Her skull is crushed, beaten to death. There's a young couple in the back. They're in bed. They get attacked. They get beaten. The man gets beaten to death, and his skull crushed. The woman gets beaten to the floor severely. She's still alive. At least they figure temporarily. Then they go upstairs and they encounter two more victims, male and a female. The female, he's hitting with these lead pipes in the skull. Her skull is basically just flattened. And then they attack her boyfriend, Billy Deverall, who tries to fight back for a while. He's got defensive wounds on him. But they kill him too. And then they take off, and, of course, we didn't know any of this at the time, but John Holmes is there, and he takes off after him. 12 hours pass, and there's a couple lives right across in the next house over, and they hear some moaning a little bit. He thinks he hears some moaning. This is like four in the afternoon the following day. And he goes over and sees the front door ajar. He sticks his head in there, and he sees the young woman, Barbara Richardson, lying on the floor with her skull crushed in. So he runs out and calls police, who show up and, of course, secure the scene. I was out horseback riding with a friend of mine. We were out in Agua Dulce, but we were on call. And I get called in all the way from there. It's about an hour and a half to get there. And Bob got called in. And by the time we get there, the media is just all over the place because these things just spread like wildfire, and it's a very narrow street up in the Hollywood Hills, very narrow. Homes are very close together, but the initial officers have everything roped off. They have the scene roped off, luckily, and Hollywood Homicide is there, and because of the tenor of the case, the number of bodies, the high-profile case, there's a lot involved. We're going to end up taking it over from the local homicide cops, which we do. So the first thing, of course, that anybody... I got there before Bob. The first thing that you do is become familiar with what they have and secure the scene. I want to make sure that the scene is secured as far out as you can. It's not just about the bodies being inside the house. You want to secure the entire area for as far out as you can get because the crime scene may lead way out one or two blocks. You don't know. We've had homicides where the suspect has even left their car behind. So we want everything secured as far out as we can get. So I make sure that had to drive the press back a little bit. And so we do an initial walkthrough, and being, you know, wary of blood and other possible hair fiber evidence that might be out there, broken glass or anything. So when you come into a house like that, there's three levels actually, but two stories. You know that there's five bodies in there, and you got to be careful where you step. So unbeknownst to us initially, until we got there, well, the young female had been removed. She was still alive when the initial responders got there, and they called for an ambulance, and they rushed her to the hospital. Her skull was crushed in, and she was not expected to live. That was Susie Lanius, who was married to the other fella in the room with her, who was dead, lying in bed, where the way he was lying, he didn't even move, while the others had all moved from their original positions. So she's still in the hospital, not expected to live, so we're stuck with this crime scene. We make all these notifications, and again, back then, no DNA. We had criminalists that were going to come out to this one because of the size and the number of victims and everything else. So they were beginning to show up. We had photographers there. But again, you had a very large crime scene, and then it was in three different locations of the house, and then from one scene to the other within the house, you had blood and other evidence. So I had a photographer there, and he's saying, you know, I've got my camera with me, too, and in the car if you ever need it. So I'm thinking, boy, why don't we just go ahead and videotape the entire crime scene with the evidence? I mean, you're going to have to still photographer anyway, and you're going to have 1,000 photographs, but we could also do a video, and that might just encapsulate what we want, and we might even be able to use this. And so he said, okay, so we go inside, and we got these cables and this big lamp, and I take them through all the entire crime scene. It takes about a half an hour, I guess. But we got everything. We got the bodies and close-ups of the bodies. We got the evidence. We got blood tailing. We've got a very interesting fresh styrations alongside the stairwell going up the stairs where the two bodies were found. And I look closer, and they're striated, indicating the first thing I thought about is a pipe. Because whoever went up the stairs, very narrow staircase, probably had a pipe and was swinging it in both sides, and it just maybe accidentally went into the side of the wall. But you can see these indentations, which is really good evidence. So we wanted that on tape. So we taped the whole thing, and unbeknownst to us, it was the first time the tape was introduced as evidence in a murder case in California. And after then, you know, just about every crime you see now, every murder now is videotaped, which I'm glad we did it because we got a lot out of it. So that was one thing. At the other, we still had to do the crime scene investigation. Now, here it is, very hot out. I think it was 90-some degrees that day. Crime scene, you don't touch anything, you don't change anything, you don't move anything until you're through with it, until it gets thoroughly documented, photographed, videotaped, written down, whatever. So all the windows had been closed up from the night before. And it's now, I don't know, about 11 the following morning, and we're still there. The bodies are still there. Nothing's been moved because we're still doing our investigation. There's that much evidence. Print people come in, and they're doing all the printing before we remove any bodies or anything else. Now, when you're through with your investigation, the coroner's office will move in and do their investigation, which basically involves just the bodies and areas around the bodies. So we're waiting that to happen, and we're right in the middle of this thing and just dead tired, and the stench is just incredible, and we've got hours to go. We ended up being there over 24 hours at the crime scene. This is something else that if you're not willing to do, and perhaps you ought to think of something else that you ought to do as a cop, because you have to take just as long as it takes. Again, these things don't happen 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. They happen at all the most any time of the day or night, and you have to stay there until you are absolutely going to get everything that you want to get, and that takes a long time sometimes. So this was our problem, and unbeknownst to us at the time, it would be 20 years before we would come to an end, and I can go on and talk about this all the way through the book, but the interesting part was it went all the way. We all know what 9/11 was. That was 20 years after this thing happened, 20 years and some months. But there was another day before 9/11, that was 9/10. That was the day the murder suspect, who'd been under indictment, Ed Nash, walked into court downtown Los Angeles and pled guilty to not to the murders because they'd already been tried and acquitted of accessory to murders. He pled accessory to murders, was found guilty, and before the sentence, he had 9/11, and when 9/11 happened, that was it. He heard no more about our case. However, meanwhile, during those 20 years, there were all sorts of things that occurred. There were other murders that had occurred. There was a federal agent who was dirty, who went into my chief and said that me and my buddy were in bed with organized crime, my partner Bob Sousa, that we were dirty cops, that we were covering for Ed Nash. This thing went on for a number of months. We were being followed by our own department. We were investigated. Of course, it was not true. They didn't find anything else. There were other things that involved these suspects. We'd worked on one of the suspects who was not part of the, was part of the initial robbery with Ed Nash, but had went to court the following day up in Sacramento. We developed a witness out of him, and he helped identifying everybody, and Nash was eventually arrested, like I said, early on, as was his bodyguard. But come to find out, the first jury came back 11-1 for guilt. There's a young girl, unbeknownst to us again, who had a brother who was in jail with a fellow by the name of Greg Dials, who was the bodyguard of Ed Nash. They were in jail together, which shouldn't have happened. They were one of the keep away, and they didn't have a keep away situation. There were gang members, and they got together and found out that the young gangbanger's sister was on the Nash and Dials jury. So bottom line is, they got to her, bought her off. She was bought off and lied about she refused to deliberate with the other 11 jurors who said he was guilty. The case hung 11-1 and had to be retried. In my opinion, you've got alternates there for a reason. One of them, she refused to cooperate. She should have been recused, and there should have been another jury appointed, and they would have been convicted. However, that didn't happen, so they were not convicted. There was another trial, and all of a sudden, you went from 11-1 for guilt to 12-0 for not guilty. So again, how many more were bought off there? We don't know. So this goes on year after year, and Holmes takes off to Florida. We got to go down there and find him as a suspect. He gets filed on, and he's acquitted also. So we got three suspects, three acquittals, and there's other people out there. So again, like I said, this went all the way to the day before 9/11, before Nash gets sentenced, and then of course all these people are now gone. That took 20 years to put that together. Sometimes that's what happens. In fact, I was retired at the time, and still they came to me and told me all this stuff. The FBI got involved with other things, and that's just another lesson on how organized crime works. You don't know who they bought off. In this case, it was a very well-placed federal agent who was feeding information to them, and then because we were getting close, tried to lay us out and said we were dirty, taking the eye off the ball for everybody else except us, saying we were part of the organized crime group. So these things kind of happen. You're never ready for them, but when they do, you got to be able to swallow it and continue on, and that's what happened.
It's an amazing story. The book tells the whole story about how all this came to pass, and it's just a recommended read. So he's Tom Lang, retired LAPD detective, who with his co-author and former partner Robert Sousa wrote both Malice in Wonderland, The Inside Story of the Police Investigation of the Laurel Canyon Murders, and The Dirty Business of Murder, The Inside Story of Homicide Investigation in the City of Angels. All my interviews with Tom are up on our website, kscj.com. Tom, just an amazing body of work you put together here with these last two books, and your Evidence Dismissed book that you co-wrote with your former partner, Philip Van Adder, was a bestseller for a reason. It was a fantastic book. So I thank you for joining me to talk about all this.
Thank you, Brian. I very much appreciate it. Anytime.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.